Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. This week, I'm joined by Mark Little, a consultant interventional radiologist at the Royal Berkshire National Health Service, or NHS Foundation Trust in Reading, here in the UK, where he's established a large embolization therapy research group alongside his clinical practice, gaining international recognition for his work into therapeutically blocking the arteries to the prostate and uterus, among others. More of that shortly. Mark initially gained a bachelor's degree in physics with medical physics from the University of Nottingham and then went on to University College London, where he was awarded a distinction for his master's in medical physics. He earned a place on the North Thames Clinical Science Training Scheme and worked in various positions at the Royal Free, Chelsea and Westminster, Charing Cross and Hammersmith Hospitals, one of my old hunting grounds, all here in the UK. During this time, he was awarded the Institute of Physics and Engineering in Medicine diploma, and having developed a fascination with radiology, Mark decided to retrain and attended Norwich Medical School, graduating as a medical doctor with distinction, and then trained as a junior doctor in Cambridge. Mark went on to receive the National Institute for Health and Care Research funded Academic Clinical Fellowship in Clinical Radiology and moved to Oxford to continue his research and then on to Reading to set up an interventional radiology unit. Mark has accrued over £1 million of research funding in the last 6 years and was awarded the NIHR Rising Star Award in 2018. Mark has taught in New York, been involved in numerous clinical trials, is involved in more research committees than I can count, and today he's here to tell us a little bit more about the fascinating world of interventional radiology. Mark and I have a number of synergies. He was also raised in North London, and also, like me, is a long-suffering Tottenham Hotspur fan, and was the first in his family to attend university. So welcome to the podcast, Professor Mark Little. It's an absolute pleasure to have you, and come on, you Spurs.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for that very, very kind and warm introduction.
Well, you're most welcome. So as I mentioned in the intro, Mark, you were the first in your family to attend higher education, as was I. What inspired your passion for science, medicine, and what was it that led you to ultimately pursue interventional radiology as a career?
Yes, well, I took a rather circuitous route into medicine. Actually, many forks in the road, as I'm sure there are in many people's careers. But the first really was, I suppose, passing my 11 plus and getting a place at grammar school. I was educated in North London, as you say, at the Latimer School. And that really taught me very early on the importance of education and learning to learn. I think us as medics, we have a great privilege of being involved in lifelong learning. And at Latimer, I took A-levels in maths, physics and religious education. And at that time at school, I actually wanted to be a pilot. I know you're a great aviator.
Yes.
Another synergy, you see. And I quite like the idea of flying around the world for BA. But unfortunately, that was curtailed by pretty severe childhood asthma. And actually, on reflection, I wonder whether my time in and out of hospital actually, you know, sort of subconsciously led me to medicine. So the sort of door on aviation closed somewhat, or commercial aviation at least. And so I decided with those three A-levels of religious education, mathematics and physics to go and pursue physics, as I didn't fancy much being an RE teacher. And whilst I was okay at maths, it wasn't really my calling. So as you pointed out in my introduction, I went to Nottingham to read physics. And I didn't really know very much about Nottingham, which was kind of showing my ignorance, I guess, or really, as you suggest, not having any one else in my family going to university. I didn't really have a clear roadmap. So I turned up to Nottingham and I was very fortunate because a sort of serendipity played a role. I was there at the time of Professor Peter Mansfield, who one of the great pioneers in magnetic resonance imaging and, of course, went on to receive the Nobel Prize. And it was just such a fertile ground of research within MRI and medical imaging. And it was sort of really the first opportunity I had to get involved in research and really see the potential future of medical imaging and medical physics. And I did my BSc thesis in functional magnetic resonance imaging of the brain, looking at activation of the motor cortex. And I was kind of hooked, really. I thought, well, medical physics is the way to go. So I then left Nottingham for the bright streets of London to become a medical physicist. And as you said in your introduction, I was fortunate to be put onto the North London Thames training scheme to become a medical physicist, and rotated around a lot of the big London teaching hospitals. And I actually specialised at that time in magnetic resonance imaging, radiotherapy and nuclear medicine, and spent pretty much, you know, every day working with radiologists and oncologists. And I kind of realized pretty early on that my passion and perhaps my skill set really lay being in front of the MRI scanner with the patients rather than behind it. So, and at that time, I also experienced my first interventional radiology procedure, and that was at the Hammersmith, actually. And that was a patient who was being treated for liver cancer using embolization therapy. And sort of my mind was blown. So I had a decision to make then, really, and that was to continue on in medical physics or go back and retrain. I'd already been at university for 5 years at this point, having undertaken my BSc and then my master's at UCL. So I decided to take the leap and went back to train to become a medical doctor. Went to Norwich, which was great time, lovely city, met my wife there. And from there to Cambridge, and spent a lot of time in the radiology department in Addenbrookes, making a real nuisance of myself. I got involved there in some research very early on, sort of continuing that sort of basic science training that I had as a physicist, and worked with a chap called Dr. Nick Higgins, who's a inspirational interventional neuroradiologist. Did a lot of work within the field of intracranial venous sinus stenting, so putting stents in the veins in the brain for patients with benign intracranial hypertension. And that was a lot of fun. And from there, went to Oxford, where I took up my research position. And my intention at going to Oxford was really to become an academic interventional neuroradiologist. But another fork in the road, really, was that because Professor Byrne, who was the prof of interventional neuroradiology, done a great deal of work within intercerebral coiling for aneurysms. He retired within a couple of weeks of me joining Oxford, so that was no good. So I didn't have a mentor, so then I kind of fell into body IR, which is everything below the clavicle, effectively. And that is really where my passion for interventional radiology developed, really. So that sort of circuitous journey of identifying what was possible as a medical physicist and then taking that leap to go back and retrain. But actually, you know, having all of that physics experience and science experience has really been massively advantageous with my subsequent career.
Yeah, it's interesting you referenced a few things there. We'll have you and I'll have to have a chat about aviation at some point. But you know, inspirational people who touch your life, and like you, I've been fortunate to have wonderful people. And I look back, and every time someone asks me about some little contribution I might have made, it's always standing on the shoulders of giants.
Absolutely.
We also talk about a passion for lifelong learning. If someone asked me just last night, if I could have my time over, what would you do? And I said exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. You know, what a privileged position to be in to say
is,
that. You know, absolutely.
It truly is. Well, I'd like to come on to some of the specifics. In about 10 years back, you became one of the first interventional radiologists to be trained in prostate artery embolization under the guidance of Professor Pisco in Portugal, before coming back to the UK to set up one of the first UK-based studies into the procedure. I love when clinical trials have great names, and this one for prostate is called the STREAM trial. I bet you're pissing yourself laughing with that one. Can you tell our readers, our listeners, a wee bit about prostate artery embolization, your research on the subject, and its role in the armamentarium of treating benign prostate disease? Because there's a lot of ways of dealing with prostate disease.
There are, absolutely. Embolization is really my passion, and that is the blocking of vessels, whether that's arteries or veins. And we're able to do a great deal of benefit by blocking arteries and veins. And So within trauma, we're able to block bleeding vessels and save people's lives leading to death. So that's obviously a very important role of embolization. Within oncology, which I've touched on, we can embolize tumors and deliver chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And then within benign disease, we're able to get into vessels to have a positive impact on specific diseases, such as ladies with uterine fibroids. We're able to shrink those fibroids by blocking the blood supply. And then within men with enlarged prostates, which is the affliction of men as we get older. And if we get to 80, 80% of us will be troubled by benign prostatic enlargement or benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, to give it its proper term. I was fascinated by the emergence of embolization within BPH, which was first described back in 2009, so pretty recently. And the pioneers were Brazil and in Portugal. They were the two big groups doing the trials. So I was fortunate enough to go to Portugal to learn about the technique under the guidance of Professor Pisco and his team in Lisbon. And they showed me the anatomy, which is quite complicated, the technique, patient selection, how to perform the procedure. And I was fascinated by the fact that you could get a patient in, perform a minimally invasive surgery with local anesthetic by going into the artery in either the groin or the wrist, wiggling our catheters under X-ray guidance into the small prostate arteries, and then blocking them using little particles like grains of sand to reduce the volume of the prostate gland and reduce the patient's symptoms. So I came back to the UK full of enthusiasm and wrote a grant to the Royal College of Radiologists, which was successful, and then devised the STREAM trial, which we carried out in Oxford. And this was a prospective cohort study looking at the technique, looking at feasibility, the clinical outcome of prostate artery embolization and safety. And during that time, there was a lot of work also going on in Southampton with Dr. Nigel Hacking, and he set up the ROPE registry, which was a trans UK trial looking at PAE. And we combined our data, and then the data worldwide was looked at, and that was taken to NICE. And I was invited to be the specialist reviewer for the NICE meeting on PAE, the specialist advisor rather. And I was very fortunate to be part of that journey. And then NICE approved PAE as a standard of care treatment on the NHS back in 2018. So that was really my journey from identifying, you know, what was possible. And as you quite rightly suggested, standing on the shoulders of those giants that went before, the pioneers in Portugal, and then bringing it back to the UK, and then setting up our own research within Oxford. And it's a fantastic procedure. We do a lot of prostate artery embolization in Reading, and we've done a lot to try and develop the technique to the benefit of patients. Where it fits in, obviously, there are a lot of treatments for BPH, rather, a lot of treatments for men with benign enlarged prostates. And I think it fits really. So in Reading, we have quite a nice stratification. We base our treatment on gland volume. So PAE works best in men with larger glands. So we wouldn't treat anyone with a gland of less than 50 mils. And so we only treat those patients with glands of 50 mils and greater. And actually, you know, gland volumes of 100 and greater is even more advantageous in many ways. As I say, it's a quick procedure, takes about an hour, day case procedure done under local anaesthetic. Recovery-wise, symptoms often get worse before they get better. And I quote a success of 80%. So 80% of men will get a significant clinical benefit with regards to their lower urinary tract symptoms. And that can last anything up to 10 years. We've got data to 10 years now. So it's a really very useful procedure to have in the armamentarium. And specific benefits over surgery are less sexual dysfunction. That seems to be a clear benefit of PAE. And it's less invasive. So, you know, comparing it to like some of the older treatments such as TURP, obviously retrograde ejaculation is much less, and incontinence is much less. So it certainly has a role within the modern approach to the treatment men with benign enlarged glands.
That's a very nice summary. Thank you. Thanks a lot for that. So moving around the body, the genicular artery has been embolized previously to address hemarthrosis in the knee, I believe, and, you know, blood in the joint. You've gained international recognition for your work with this, with embolizing this artery for knee osteoarthritis, and you received the CVIR Editor's Medal in 2022. It's the most prestigious annual research award from the Cardiovascular Interventional Radiological Society of Europe, bit of a mouthful, and of which you recently became a fellow. The award was for the Genesis 1 trial in genicular artery embolization. Can you tell our listeners a wee bit more about the work you've been doing in this field? And although we largely have a medical audience, Mark, we do have a lot of people who listen in who are just interested lay folks. So maybe just start and explain the anatomy and what the pathology is you're addressing.
Sure, sure. So genicular artery embolization is another type of embolization. So another procedure that we block vessels. And in GAE, we are blocking the small abnormal arteries that arise from the genicular arteries, which are the blood vessels that supply the knee. The scientific rationale behind genicular artery embolization comes from the data which has shown that abnormal blood vessels can be found within the soft tissue lining of patients' knees with osteoarthritis. And this abnormal blood vessel formation has been found to release messengers. We call them cytokines. And these messengers are key within the upregulation of inflammation within the knee. So those messengers cause the pain that these patients experience with osteoarthritis. And they also cause a disruption of cartilage. So they cause the propagation of the osteoarthritis. So as interventional radiologists, we can exploit these new abnormal blood vessels and block them by embolization, therefore preventing the release of these messengers, therefore getting control of patients' pain and pausing the disease process. So that's the theory upon which genicular artery embolization is based. And like with PAE, I saw some of the early data, and that was coming out of Japan, a guy called Yuji Okunu, who's very much revered as the father of MSK emblotherapy. And we can talk about that in the wider round in a little while. And so I sat down again with my sort of researcher's hat on and said, well, we should start a trial to look at this because, you know, everyone's got osteoarthritis of the knee. And there are a lot of people that are really have an unmet treatment need. So you've got those patients who've got mild to moderate disease that have conservative treatments. They might have physiotherapy or a steroid injection, and they may benefit for a little period of time. Then you've got a big gap where there is this unmet treatment need before patients are offered knee replacement surgery. So it was that unmet treatment need, those patients that have failed conservative treatment but are not yet severe enough to warrant knee replacement surgery, where I thought, well, this has the potential to really help here. And it's had potential to help, you know, millions and millions of patients. So I set about designing the Genesis 1 study with my research group in Reading. And this was the first trial of its type in Europe to investigate genicular artery embolization for patients with OA. It was a feasibility trial. We wanted to try and elucidate whether it was feasible. We wanted to assess the safety and we wanted to look at outcomes. And that trial started in 2018. We've just finished it, actually. So we've just had our final 2-year follow-up. So the trial is closed and we're about to publish the long-term data from that trial. But the interim analysis, which was planned, was published back in 2021 in CVIR, for which we won the Editor's Medal. And it really validated what we were doing. Because whenever you start something new, you know, people think you're a bit nuts. And when I first proposed this idea to my orthopedic surgeons, they thought I was a bit crazy that I was going to block the arteries of the knee. They thought the knee was all going to fall apart. But it wasn't the knee per se. It's within the synovium, within the hypervascular part of the knee that is driving the pain. And so it was a great award to get, and hugely grateful for the team, really. And you know, anyone who's done academia knows that it is a purely team pursuit. So it really validated what we were doing as a team. And to that end, with the results of Genesis 1, I went to NICE, like I did with PAE, and said, look, there is this new procedure. I'd like you to look at it because it has the potential to benefit NHS patients. And they looked at it and they said, yes, this is okay. The safety profile looks good, but we need more data. We need longer term data and we need randomized data, because clearly any intervention that's designed to treat pain, we must consider the placebo effect. And so they wanted specifically randomized trials against the placebo. So I went off and designed Genesis 2, which we are in the midst of currently. And that is a large 110 patient, one-to-one sham randomized controlled trial, which we're running in Reading. And that really will help to answer the question of the placebo effect with the design of that study, because half the patients will get salty water injected. It's exactly the same procedure. The other half will get the embolic actually blocking the abnormal vessel. So the IR community is really excited to see the results of that study. And really the potential of this procedure is huge, actually, as with a lot of other MSK embolotherapy procedures.
I actually recently had my knees x-ray because I was having a bit of pain, but was delighted to be told that there was no radiologic arthritis. They still bloody hurt, mind you. So maybe you and I will be talking. So let's again wander. Well, we've started in the perineum, we've gone down to the knee. Let's come back up into the pelvis. Uterine artery embolization. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, another embolization procedure, which again, you know, extremely passionate about. This is probably the longest amount of data, or the most amount of data, I should say, on any embolotherapy. It was first conceived back in the 70s, but the main amount of data came in the 90s. And it's used to treat women with uterine fibroids, which are benign growths that occur in the uterus. And they can have a profound impact on patients' quality of life. They can cause excess bleeding at the time of menses. They can cause pain. They can cause pressure effects. And they can have a really disabling impact. So what we can do as interventional radiologists is we can get into the uterine arteries that supply blood flow to not only the uterus, but the fibroids. These fibroids are benign vascular tumors. And we can block the blood supply to those growths, which causes them to shrink down, which enables the mass and pressure effects to be alleviated. And it also can reduce significantly the bleeding that these patients experience. We've done a lot of work looking at trying to optimize the pathway of uterine artery embolization. The procedure, unlike a lot of embolization procedures, can be painful. So we've done a lot of work trying to optimize the analgesia and the pathway for that, because often these women have very large fibroid masses. And obviously the amount of embolic you put in and the amount of blood supply that you're blocking can cause quite a marked ischemic effect, which is where the pain comes from. So we've done a lot of work researching optimization of that. And we've done a lot of work within my research group looking at the neuropsychology around pain. And this is something that we've also applied to the knee, because these patients have often had their pain and symptoms for many, many years. And so unpicking chronic pain and how that impacts within the embolization procedure is very, very interesting. Within the knee, we've done some work which has found a link between catastrophizing and clinical outcomes. And actually, the neural connectivity between the dorsal prefrontal cortex actually alters in patients with chronic pain. So there's a lot of work around that, and we can apply that to patient selection and augmentation of how we treat patients to try and optimize clinical outcomes. So uterine artery embolization, been around for a long while, great procedure, but still work to be done in terms of optimization of technique and benefit for our patients.
So changing topic slightly, a couple of years back, you were involved in the TARGET trial, which used augmented reality to guide prostate cancer biopsy. Any man who's had a prostate biopsy will attest to the fact that there are much better ways of spending an afternoon. This work sounds fascinating. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of hype within AI and AR. And I think that you know, we kind of gone through this phase of you put AI or AI on any research application and automatically you get money. And I'm kind of against that. So I'm very much trying to pick applications of technology that will benefit patients rather than designing technology for the sake of technology, if that makes sense. And with the Target trial, what I conceived was I quite like the idea of using the HoloLens device, which is a headset that's produced by Microsoft. And what you can do with that device is you can create holograms, so medical holograms. So if you have a CT scan, you can create a three-dimensional hologram and you can interact with that hologram in real time in so-called mixed reality. So you have the hologram in front of you with this headset on, but you can interact with it and actually see your hands. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could create a 3D hologram of an MRI of a patient with prostate cancer? So we could then use that hologram, that 3D hologram, and overlay it in real time onto a patient who's having a prostate biopsy. So we could therefore see where the tumor is, the target, hence the name, where the prostate tumor is in the mixed reality, so that would then guide needle placement. So we designed a feasibility trial where we used the technology and we partnered with a company called Apukla, who've got the tech to enable us to create these 3D holograms. And we were able to utilize that to place over patients whilst they're in theater to then biopsy the lesion. Because traditionally, and I mean, there are commercially available systems out there, but many of them use or rely on having to use fiducial markers. And it's quite clunky and labor intensive. So we wanted a technique where you put the visor on, you can then place this hologram on the patient and away you go. It's certainly an iterative process. And this was very much the first phase of the research. And it's finished. We've submitted to publication for peer review. But I think, you know, the technology is there. And we really want to work now with the company to try and optimize it. And there are certainly further steps that need to be taken to improve the accuracy and how we can apply it. But that was really the premise. And I think that AR, augmented reality, and creating these holograms to guide biopsies and enable us to understand the anatomy will have a role within interventional radiology or image-guided surgery, as I think it's probably better described, actually.
Okay, well, you mentioned AI in your initial answer, and because you're right, it's popping up everywhere. And about artificial intelligence, I'd like to see some real intelligence. And I've seen all sorts of projects being done in your specialty in radiology. In fact, I saw one recently looking at AI evaluating chest CTs for response to these very expensive new chemotherapeutic agents to ascertain which patient, like a biomarker, if you will, which patient will and will not respond. So AI, tell us about the role of AI in radiology.
Yeah, I mean, AI, I mean, it's everywhere, isn't it? I mean, you know, from ChatGPT and, you know, it's taking over the world, the bots are coming. And I think, you know, radiology is very well placed to lead a lot of the research within AI, because medical imaging, you know, we can't keep up with medical imaging. That's a fact. You know, if you look at the number of scans that are being done and the number of radiologists, you know, scanning is exponential and the workforce is sort of slowly ticking up. But we need help. And I think really to be a radiologist that doesn't embrace AI and technology, it is a poor thing. I think, you know, you're going to come a cropper. I think, you know, to embrace it is the way forward, I think. But we shouldn't go in blind. We need to make sure that the technology is making our lives better and making the lives of our patients better. And I'll give you a couple of real life examples where I think it does benefit. So in the Royal Barracks in Reading, we were one of the first hospitals to get Brainomics in. And Brainomics is a company that came out of Oxford, I believe. And they created a system that enables the detection of clots in the brain. So if you have a stroke, obviously time is brain, you want to have your diagnosis as quickly as possible, but then you also want to get your treatment as quickly as possible. And interventional neuroradiology has really revolutionized stroke treatment. We're able now to go up into the brain and get rid of the clot extraction, and the outcomes can be absolutely amazing. You know, going in with a dense weakness in one side, having the clot retrieved, and literally being rolled out of the angio suite, being able to move. So if I have my stroke, that's what I want. And so to get to that, though, you need to be in the window for intervention. So this technology enables automated recognition of clots, and it alerts the reporter that there is a clot and where it is. So I see that as a benefit. Technology enabling advancing the speed of diagnosis and having a real impact on patient outcome. And from a radiology perspective, it's great because it's a checkpoint. So we can report the scan, and then that's sort of another set of eyes, if you will. But it also enables the clinicians at the front door to have access to the imaging so that they get a first dibs on it and say, oh, well, actually, there is a clot there. Let's alert the radiologist. This is the scan that they need to look at first. Now, it's not fail-safe, of course, because it doesn't look at bleeding, for example. So a patient might have a clot in their brain. They may also have a subdural hematoma. Obviously, you wouldn't want to thrombolize, give someone clot-busting drugs if they've got a bleed in the brain and a clot at the same time. So it helps and aids the radiologist, but it's not foolproof.
I couldn't agree more. So, Mark, what other innovations are on the horizon for interventional radiology?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, interventional radiology are the great innovators. And I think where my research, certainly the last 6 years, has been within genicular artery embolization, osteoarthritis, but that's really the tip of the iceberg. I think musculoskeletal embolotherapy has burst onto the scene in the last 10 years. And the data that's coming out of the Far East, Japan, South Korea, is frightening, actually. So what can they treat? Well, they're treating Achilles tendinopathy, plantar fasciitis, osteoarthritis of the hand, golfers and tennis elbow, adhesive capsulitis, patellar tendinopathy. I mean, you name it. Wherever there's inflammation within a tendon and enthesis, they can embolize it. And the data is phenomenal. The reason why we're not going at pace with the other areas is we're really limited by the tech. What we need are resorbable embolics. Let me explain. So what that is a device that goes into an artery, blocks it off for a period of time, and then disappears without a trace. Now, you can imagine that if you're trying to inject particles, say, into the fingers, if you've got osteoarthritis of the DIP of the fingers, which is obviously very, very common, then you don't want a permanent particle because your finger will become ischemic and drop off. And that's obviously a bad outcome. So what you need are resorbable particles, temporary embolics that stay there and get rid of these abnormal neovessels that are causing the problem, but then disappear in a time frame that enables reperfusion to the bones, cartilage, and alike, and doesn't cause harm. And in the Far East, what they're using is this mythical substance called imipenem and cilastatin, which is a very old antibiotic, which, when it comes into contact with blood, acts like a temporary embolic agent. The issue in the UK and the US is that it's not licensed. So I've been doing a lot of work with a startup company called Cranmed in Ireland, and we've been working on a bespoke temporary embolic agent for MSK embolotherapy. And I really think that if the data can replicate that's coming out of the Far East, this will have a profound impact on the way in which we treat musculoskeletal and sports injury conditions going forwards. And, you know, the rest of my career, I'm sure, will be spent researching the plethora of conditions that embolization has the potential to benefit. So that's where I think the great future within embolotherapy lies in MSK?
Well, my guess is that the world is going to be making a beaten path to your door, because it sounds like you and your colleagues are designing a better mousetrap. I mean, I trained as a surgeon, and when I trained, you know, it was a bloody great big subcostal incision for a gallbladder, and I was very fortunate to be involved in helping introduce laparoscopic surgery, where we turned a seven-day hospitalization into an outpatient procedure. My final question, which I like to ask everyone, if there was a magical genie who could grant you three wishes in your area or any area of healthcare, frankly, what would those wishes be? And yet you can say for Spurs to win the
league. Goes without asking, doesn't it? Goes without saying. I mean, yeah, yeah, Spurs to win the league would be my one, two, and three.
Yeah.
I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and I must say that your guests always give some amazing answers. And I fear I might give it, be a bit of a disappointment, a bit underwhelming. But my three wishes really are born out of the great desire for interventional radiology to thrive. And they are structure, data, and generalizability. And I'll go through each in turn, if I may. So structure. So interventional radiology is the newest medical specialty, if you can call it that. And I think that part of that lies with the issues I'm going to discuss. But it was on the 16th of January 1964 that Charles Dotter performed his first angioplasty. So it's only 60 years old. And in that time, we've innovated at pace within vascular, non-vascular, embolization, oncology, trauma, you name it, interventional radiology has innovated. And we now treat patients within every body system. And I think we've got a bit of an identity crisis, actually. I've mentioned briefly that I think interventional radiologists probably should be known as image-guided surgeons. I align my day-to-day job more as a surgeon than perhaps a radiologist. And I do clinics, I see patients on the ward, I operate on patients, and I see them at follow-up. And I think the issue around that is that the structure of interventional radiology has not kept pace with the reality of the job. And so we would need better identification of trainees that want to be interventional radiologists. We need better training structure. We need a better structure of the clinical firm, because at the moment we provide a purely consultant-led service. We need registrars, junior doctors to enable us to provide the optimum patient care that we need. We also need, you know, dedicated secretariat and access to inpatient beds. Now, many centres will have those. We're very fortunate in Reading, but there is a great deal of heterogeneity around the provision of IR care, not least with regard to on-call. So I think structure is really important, because the pace at which we've developed has not kept up with that. My next wish would be data. And that kind of ties into structure, because to provide data, you need time. And to have time, you need the structure that I've described to enable you to have the space to be a clinical scientist. And there aren't many clinical academics in IR, and actually IR has not really been seen as an academic specialty. But I think with innovation, we need to produce level one data. And I think we've done that with GAE. With PAE. We're trying to do that with GAE. We've done that within the oncology space, because without data, it's the only way we get into guidelines. So we need to really concentrate our efforts on research. And I would really implore funders to fund interventional radiology research, because I think it's really important, and it's important for our patients. And then finally, generalizability. And this is really, we need interventional radiology procedures to be offered to everyone. And that's not just in the UK, where, you know, there's heterogeneity within the West, but also in developing countries. And if we look at sub-Saharan Africa, and Africa as a continent, postpartum hemorrhage and maternal death is still a problem. In fact, 70% of maternal deaths occur in Africa. And we know that interventional radiology has a huge role to play within bleeding and postpartum hemorrhage through embolization. So if I could have a wish from the genie, it would be to enable all patients and all of those mothers to have access to interventional radiology and reduce the mortality associated. Wouldn't it be fantastic if there was access to care across the world for all of the procedures we offer, not just embolization, but non-vascular, vascular cancer treatments. That would be great. And I think that ties directly with producing data and having a structure. So my big wish really is for more people to be aware of interventional radiology and image-guided surgery, and to ask your doctors to refer to for these procedures, because they are life-changing. And I want to really highlight that it can be a great option for many, many patients. So they would be my three wishes: structure, data, generalizability.
I love your appetite for knowledge. I love your enthusiasm for innovation, and I love your dedication to the care of patients. As we said earlier, we're very privileged chaps to have spent our lives doing this, and you're a kindred spirit. I'm afraid that's all we've got time to talk about today, but I'd love to have you back on. Really want to thank you, Professor Mark Little, for taking the time to share your knowledge with us. It's absolutely been illuminating.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure to be a part of the podcast, and love to come back anytime. Thank you, Jonathan.
And you and I have got to catch up and talk about talk football like we know what we're talking about, like all football supporters. So, folks, please join us again next week for another fascinating episode of the EMJ podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Check out the archives. Tell your friends, like us on social media, blah, 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 blah. You know all that. Until the next time, I'm Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Please look after yourselves. Stay safe. Stay well. Stay curious. Bye for now.